Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be trying to take a general overview of the Bush energy plan. As I say, we're talking with a representative of a group that has been critical of the plan, that is the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. And our guest is Ana Aurelio. She's the legislative director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. She's responsible for policy development, for research and advocacy on energy issues, ranging all the way from utility restructuring to nuclear waste. She holds bachelor's degree in physics from University of Massachusetts at Amherst and master's degree in environmental engineering from MIT. Before getting her master's degree, she was a staff scientist with the National Environmental Law Center and also then for 3 years with PERG's National Litigation Project. We're talking this morning with her by telephone, and as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. Anyone who's interested in calling in can do that. We ask callers just to try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many people as possible. But anybody's welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. Any place the signal will travel, that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the letters and the numbers, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Aurelio, hello.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
It's great that you're going to have Diane Brown on because I work for her national office. She's on my board of directors.
Very good. Well, we did, as I said, we had some coal guys here on the show the other day, so mm-hmm. we thought at least we should get another side on this
Absolutely.
Thing specifically, because here the legislature has been involved in some work in trying to stimulate the coal industry in Illinois that's been in some decline, just like I guess the coal industry has been in decline lots of places.
So right, right.
We'll look at some of those things tomorrow.
Yeah, great.
Well, generally speaking, and we can get into some of the specifics, but generally speaking, what was the reaction of your organization to the proposals that Mr. Bush made?
Well, David, generally what we find is that the Bush energy plan is dirty, dangerous, and it doesn't deliver for consumers. President Bush is exploiting people's fears about rolling blackouts, and obviously they're actually experiencing them in California, and he's exploiting people's fears about skyrocketing gasoline prices, which I believe folks in Illinois are seeing, and instead of coming up with an energy plan that will help us deal with those problems, his plan basically rewards many of the same companies that we feel are causing these energy problems.
Mm-hmm. Your concern, and I think it's the concern of others, is that there is still too much reliance on fossil fuels, particularly petroleum,
yes.
And not the kind of influence that we should be putting on, or the kind of energy interest that we should be putting into things like efficiency, renewables, conservation, and so forth.
Yeah, the bottom line is, David, that we are too reliant on unsustainable sources of energy, and they are unsustainable for our environment and our health. Fossil fuels, as you know, cause all kinds of pollution. Tomorrow you'll hear from our state office, Diane Brown. We'll talk about the impact of coal burning on people's health, for example. It has dramatic impacts there. We estimate that burning fossil fuels in the country, so burning gasoline in cars, burning diesel in trucks, burning coal in power plants, leads to 60,000 premature deaths a year, and that's been backed up by scientific studies. That's a huge impact. Burning these fossil fuels also will lead to global warming that will affect the future of the entire planet. And then obviously the reliance on nuclear power, which, you know, in terms of electricity is about 20% of total electricity in Illinois. I know your percentage is higher.
Mm-hmm.
That has saddled us with lethal radioactive waste, and there's no safe place to put it. So we've made some bad decisions in the past, and PERG is hoping that the debate over these energy prices will lead us to a new energy future, a cleaner, smarter energy future. And unfortunately, we see President Bush's plans as bringing us backwards in time and making us more reliant on these dirty sources rather than moving forward.
Hmm. I think one of the things that happened after the administration put its plan out there was that then surveys started to be done and a little bit of public opinion started to be gathered. And it seemed that people felt that the administration had indeed made a mistake in ignoring the potential for renewables and for efficiency. has that led the administration to modify its position at all, or to start talking a little bit more about the idea of saving energy and more efficient use of energy?
Yeah, I think what happened was the vice president did a speech in Toronto where he basically insulted a whole lot of people who believe in doing things smarter by being more efficient, and said, well, you know, conservation may be a nice personal virtue, but it's no way to run an energy policy. And shortly after that, the administration got a lot of feedback from not just environmental groups or public interest groups, but actual utility operators who said, well, hold on, wait a second. You know, we're seeing that energy efficiency programs that we, the electric utility industry, have put in place really help us, because it's, in most cases, it is half as expensive to reduce demand for electricity by helping consumers become more energy efficient than it is to build a new power plant to provide more electricity. So even electric utilities sort of, you know, came back to him and said, well, you might want to rethink this. And so what we did see, you know, right before the Bush Energy Plan came out, was increasing amount of talk and conversation from the Bush administration on energy efficiency. The problem is that his plan is very short on actual guarantees. So he's got some incentives in there for energy efficient buildings and cars, et cetera, but there's no guarantees. And the one big example that we like to use is, you know, his plan wants to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil drilling. According to the U.S. Geological Service, there's probably 6 months' worth of oil up there, and it couldn't get to the lower 48 for 10 years. Now, that's if it ever gets here, because the oil companies lobbied for and got a repeal of a law in 1996 that now allows them to export oil that they drill in Alaska. Before then, they had to keep it all in this country, increase domestic oil supply. But actually, the oil companies, who've been clamoring to drill in the Arctic Refuge in the name of increasing national security, actually are allowed to export domestically produced oil, and could very well go ahead and drill in the Arctic Refuge and then send it to Japan or some other Asian country. So drilling in the Arctic Refuge isn't going to help us now, and at best it will provide us 6 months' worth of oil. Instead of doing that, we want President Bush to immediately set stronger miles per gallon standards for cars and light trucks. This will have the impact of, one, getting cars and trucks on the market using technologies available today that will go further on a gallon of gas. We estimate over the next 10 years we could see a 60% improvement using existing technologies. This would save us $60 billion at the pump, and that's at lower prices of gasoline. If they do skyrocket higher than what we're seeing right now, the savings, the consumer savings, would be even greater. And we would save 15 times as much oil as we could ever get out of the Arctic Refuge. So those are the kinds of contrasts. You know, on the one hand, he is bowing to the interests of the oil companies and pushing to open the Arctic Refuge for drilling. The real solution, from PERG's point of view, is to increase miles per gallon standards so we save oil and save money. The Bush Energy Plan says we need to study that issue further.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Ana Aurelio. She's legislative director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, and we're talking about the Bush energy proposals. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second on the drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, now, do you think now that the control of the Senate has passed to the Democrats, is it likely that that's going to happen?
Well, the drilling in the Arctic Refuge requires legislation to allow it to happen, because it is currently protected. Even before Senator Jeffords decided to switch from the Republican Party to becoming an independent, thus giving control of the Senate to the Democrats, even before that happened, there were enough moderate Republicans who sided with most but not all of the Democrats in opposing drilling in the Arctic Refuge, that I don't think, and the leadership admitted, that they could not have won a straight up or down vote on the Senate floor even before the switch in the party control happened. Now that the Democrats actually chair the committees, which would have to report out that legislation. I think the likelihood that we will see that legislation this year becomes very, very dim, which is good news for the Arctic Refuge and the native people that live up there who don't want to see any drilling.
Mm-hmm. Again, here to go back to your recommendation that we should mandate an increase in fuel efficiency for cars and trucks. What are the levels now? So you're talking about for cars, we should go to 45 miles a gallon, and for trucks, for light trucks, 34.
Yes.
What are they now?
Right now, it's 27.5 miles per gallon for trucks, and it's 20.1. I mean, for cars, it's 27.5, and for trucks and SUVs, minivans, et cetera, it's 20.1.
Hmm.
So they're and they've stagnated. The last time that these levels got changed was really 1985. The Clinton administration raised the light truck standard by 0.1 mile per gallon, so not a real relief there. And so these standards were initially set in 1975. They effectively doubled the fuel economy of the cars at that time. And at the time, light trucks were given this lower standard because they were mostly being used as farm vehicles. And there weren't that many of them. And now what you see is auto manufacturers are seeing that they can make a huge profit on these SUVs. I mean, they make tens of thousands of dollars worth of pure profit on some of these bigger vehicles, and they take advantage of the loophole in the miles per gallon standard to build these. And folks are driving them as cars, so that, you know, half of the cars being sold today are these heavier, bigger vehicles that are using more gasoline. So we're increasing our consumption of gasoline. The real opportunity for us as a country is that during that time, the auto manufacturers have also improved their technology. So it is absolutely possible to build both the larger SUVs and trucks that could go 40% further on a gallon of gasoline and smaller cars to go 40% further on a gallon of gasoline. That's all possible, and we ought to take advantage of this technology by updating the standards.
So if the manufacturers of the cars and trucks and the FUVs can do it, why don't they just do it?
Well, actually, Ford Motor Company and General Motors both, seeing that people are becoming concerned about this issue once again with the skyrocketing gasoline prices, they actually have announced that they are going to increase their fuel economy for certain models of light trucks. I've always been a little perplexed as to why the auto industry has fought so hard. I think one reason is they just don't want to be told what to do. And I think that actually has a lot to do with it, that they want to be able to sell whatever they can sell with the biggest profit margins. And, you know, when consumers really start getting angry, well, then maybe they'll move a little bit. But I always say we have the technology, set the standard, and they can build it, and, you know, it'll be better for all of us.
Yeah, I guess it was my understanding that one of the big things that they have done to increase fuel efficiency is simply to make the vehicles lighter. Is there more to it than that? Are there things, for example, you can do to the way that engines are designed to make them use less gasoline?
Oh, yeah. And, in fact, the auto industry and folks who are against raising the standards, you know, always want to talk about making cars lighter and less safe, et cetera. And that's just really, I guess people like to call that like a red herring. The fact of the matter is car efficiency doubled from 1975 to 1985. Cars on the road in 1985 and today are safer than cars that were on the road in 1970s. They go further on a gallon of gas. They use materials that some of them might be lighter, but they're also stronger because we have better technology, better making the lighter materials into better shape so that they're stronger. The bottom line is that they're much, much safer, and the auto industry has always resisted these kinds of technological improvements. Remember, the auto industry resisted putting in airbags until people overwhelmingly started buying up the models that had the airbags, and then the auto industry voluntarily started putting in airbags in all their models ahead of time. So they like to point to stuff like this that just isn't true. The National Academy of Sciences took a look at, in the past, how did we increase this fuel economy, and found that 85% of the changes in the cars had to do with better aerodynamics, so making cars, you know, float through the air better, better rolling resistance for tires. There's a lot you can do with increasing fuel economy just by having better tires, better performance, better handling, and more efficient engines. So 85% of the changes actually had to do with that as opposed to weight.
Mm-hmm. And if we, say, for the next model year, we did that, we mandated that, and they could do that quickly, they could start turning out new cars. Obviously, it's going to take some time for enough of these cars to get out there to make a big difference. I mean, how long would it really take before we saw a significant decrease in our consumption of gasoline in this country?
Well, we are supporting a bill right now in the Senate that has been co-sponsored by Senators Feinstein and Snow. Senator Feinstein is a Democrat from California. Senator Snow is a Republican from Maine. Their bill actually says exactly what you're saying. Let's start ramping up the standards over time. And so they actually mandate that there would be an increase in efficiency, a 2 mile per gallon improvement in just light trucks by 2002. So if their bill were to be implemented, we could see more efficient light trucks on the market as quickly as the next year and a half. The auto fleet will take about 10 years to turn over so that the majority of the cars are the newer, more fuel-efficient ones. So, and in order to get a 60% improvement in efficiency, we estimate, and we would give the auto industry 10 years as well. So we're talking about 10 years, which coincidentally is about the same amount of time that it would take oil from the Arctic refuge to ever reach us. And our solution would give people more efficient cars and save them money. Unfortunately, President Bush's solution would destroy a pristine wilderness area, and people could still be paying the same prices at the gas pump, because the important issue here is that, you know, U.S. oil production, we only have 3% of economically recoverable reserves in the world. So the U.S., no matter how much we drill, we can't control the world price of oil. We'll still be hostage to the OPEC nations, and that's why it's a better solution if you're worried about high gasoline prices to start removing your dependence on oil by having more efficient cars than it is to start drilling everywhere in the U.S., because there's no way we can affect that overall price anyway.
Mm. Certainly, when you look at our energy consumption, an awful lot goes into personal transportation. It's the cars that we drive, and it seems like there's only so much you can do. I'm sure we could do more with mass transit, but we're still going to have some people who are going to want and need their own vehicles. What possibility do you think there is? What potential do you think there is for cars that run on something other than gasoline?
Well, David, that's a really good question, because in addition to making us too dependent on expensive gasoline, burning gasoline in cars also releases carbon dioxide, which is the number one global warming pollutant. And just this spring, 2,000 scientists, the International Panel on Climate Change, so 2,000 of the top scientists in the world who work on climate change, warned us once again that climate change is happening, it will have devastating effects, and it's being caused by burning fossil fuel, including gasoline in cars. So over the long term, if we want to deal with the problem of global warming, if we want to deal with other air pollution problems, so smog, for example, is one other problem that comes from burning gasoline, burning coal in power plants, but we'll stick to cars right now with burning gasoline, it makes sense for us to have a longer-term vision that will get us away from burning so much gasoline in cars. There's a couple of very exciting potential technologies. First is hybrid vehicles. That means cars that burn gasoline but also capture some of the energy. For example, when you slow down in the car, they capture that energy as electrical power. And so those cars, and there's some cars on the road today, the Toyota Prius and the Honda Insight, and they get 50 to 70 miles per gallon, that are already sort of using this dual electrical gasoline technology. That means you burn less gasoline and you're using high tech. The potential for hybrid vehicles is much, much greater. And some people, including a legendary physicist, Amory Lovins, has envisioned hypercars of the future that will use very advanced technologies, very advanced hybrid engines that could get as much as, you know, several hundred miles per gallon of gasoline. So that's the kind of stuff that we ought to be thinking about. And so we need to take the first step right now and at least start improving the standards, because remember, the last time we actually saw an increase in the standards was 1985.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. In Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm completely convinced with your argument, and have been for a number of years. The trouble is, whenever I hear you and others proposing what you do propose, you pay very little attention to the fact that there are people involved who earn a living in the industries that are affected by improvement in efficiency getting rid of our reliance on carbon fuels. The auto workers are afraid of losing their source of livelihood. Therefore, the United Auto Workers are opposed to many of the things that are being proposed for the auto industry. The truck drivers are afraid of being put out of work because eventually, if we're going to improve matters in that area, we're going to have to switch from long-haul truck driving to railroads and that sort of thing. The coal miners are afraid of being put out of work and so on. And you've got to propose and make and develop some campaign for providing an alternative for the people who work in these industries, and training programs, educational programs, developing other types of industries, and there's very little said about this entire problem, and these people are very concerned.
I think you raise an excellent point. And one of the things with, obviously, building cars that are more efficient, that keeps people working in the auto industry. You're still building the cars. And I actually, when I graduated from college with a degree in physics, I would have really like to have had the chance to build some sort of revolutionary new car. I think that would be actually a very attractive job opportunity for people who are wondering what to do next in their lives. So we absolutely want to make sure that folks who work in the auto industry, either keep working in the auto industry and building these new cars, or have some sort of transition program. The next thing is energy efficiency as a whole. We are currently dependent on foreign oil for almost 60%. So we're sending millions of dollars overseas to other countries to build their economies. If you are not so dependent on foreign oil and you're not wasting money because your cars are going further on a gallon of gas, you can spend that money right here in the States, and that's good for the economy. So wasting less energy is good for the economy. It puts money in consumers' pockets, and we can use that to create jobs here in the States. And in fact, there have been studies. For example, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy says that if we raise these miles per gallon standards, the savings at the pump, so this extra $60 billion a year that we would save at the pump, and remember, most of that money would be going overseas to foreign countries to build their economy. If we kept it here in this country, it would be about an increase of 244,000 jobs nationwide. And because you would be improving auto technology, you could actually see about 47,000 new jobs in the auto industry. So I actually think our solution is good for workers and good for the rest of the country.
Yes, but this message isn't coming across, that particular part of it. And what I say is that you're relying on a laissez-faire attitude that things will automatically come about through technology, but you're not directing your attention to trying to convince the people in these areas, and in the meantime, they're providing a good bit of the opposition to these intelligent programs. And I think there's a blindness on your part and the people who are associated with you.
Well, We would be happy to talk to anybody in the unions that want to come together on a plan like this. We have been part of a dialogue that's been going on between some of the national environmental groups and some of the bigger unions as well to talk about how we can move forward on a range of environmental and global climate change issues. And so we're certainly open and willing to do that. And again, we don't have a laissez-faire attitude. We want standards. We want standards for cleaner cars that go further on a gallon of gasoline, and our research shows that that will actually help the economy and help jobs.
Well, are you approaching these various sectors of the economy, the unions and so on, and making a direct effort to try to convince them? Are you propagandizing?
Wait,
necessary also.
We're trying to do that, and this is a difficult issue, as you pointed out. But we are trying to do that, and PIRG and other groups would be happy to meet with more folks from the union part of the world. And we're engaged in an ongoing dialogue with, you know, some of the bigger unions, as I said.
Well, what unions are you engaged with?
The AFL-CIO.
Well, that's too
high
up on
the group. Yeah, and the United Auto Workers are a part of that, and we'd be happy to talk to more folks.
The independent unions, the United Auto Workers, don't pay any attention to the people in Washington. They consider themselves independent and they act on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been so for generations now. What you have to do is make direct approaches and not wait for them to come to you. Just being willing to talk to them is insufficient.
Well, I think you're making an excellent point, and we'll make a greater effort.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I have another caller I want to get to, and I want to also introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit. We're speaking with Ana Aurelio. She's legislative director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. She is responsible for policy development, research, and advocacy on energy issues ranging all the way from utility restructuring to nuclear waste. And if you have questions, comments, we're here talking about the Bush Energy Plan. PIRG is one of those groups that has been critical of it on a number of points, in most around the idea that it doesn't really do what it should do to increase our energy efficiency and also increase use of renewable energy sources. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Here we got somebody on a car phone, so I want to get right to them. On line one, hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you for all the comments. I appreciate the point of view that's being placed across here. It's very nice to hear. And the question that I have is it true that the Bush administration's new monetary policy has reduced the research money for new types of new approaches to utilization of energy and new types of energy?
Yes. What the Bush administration came out with their budget proposal about a month and a half, 2 months before the Bush Energy Plan, and this budget proposal actually is going to be starting to get debated this week in the Congress. Again, this goes back to what David was asking about how the Bush administration had gotten, you know, some bad public feedback after they focused so much on energy supplies, dirty energy supplies, and not enough on efficiency and renewables. One harbinger of their plan was actually their budget. They cut renewable energy funding, so funding for solar and wind programs, for example, by 50%. That's their proposed cut. And they cut energy efficiency funding with the exception of one program, which we were happy to see they actually increased funding for. It's called the Weatherization Assistance Program. This helps low- and middle-income folks weatherize their homes so that your overall energy bills are lower. It's an excellent program, which they actually proposed increasing. But they cut funding for other energy efficiency programs. For example, programs to research new technologies that will help, for example, windows become more efficient so that you can keep more heat inside your house in the wintertime and not heat up in the summertime so much from the sun coming into your house. Those programs got cut by about 26%, so quite big budget cuts when it comes to clean energy programs. And that's one of the things that PERG and other groups are trying to reverse now in the Congress, because now it's Congress's turn to set budget numbers in the bills. And like I said, it's already happening this week in the House of Representatives. They will start developing the bill that funds energy efficiency programs in the House.
Well, I think it's I'm glad to see that this, the public becomes aware of this. And also, the other thing is, I think conservation is great, and I think we should pursue that line, but I think maybe we should go along for new sources. What do you think about hydrogen and the fuel cells as opposed to the fossil fuel?
Well, that's a really good point that you're raising. And one of the ideas for automobiles of the future, for example, is to have them run on fuel cells. What this would do is you take hydrogen and oxygen, you mix it together, and you make water, and you release energy, electricity. It's very, very clean. The question with hydrogen is, where do you get it from? And we would like to see more research being done on generating hydrogen through renewable energy sources. So if you had a way of converting solar energy into electricity that then could get hydrogen, you store the hydrogen in these fuel cells, and they are an excellent and very clean way of creating energy. There's a lot of work being done on looking at fuel cells for cars. There's a lot of work being done on fuel cells to power hospitals and buildings. Some of those are already on the market today. And the real question in terms of a really clean energy future is, can we get the hydrogen in a clean fashion? And research on that is being done, but obviously more should happen.
Yes, and was that any of that research part of what was cut?
I believe part of the fuel cell research was cut. I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head.
Well, is there any consideration to hydrolysis of water by making current energy plants 100% operational, running hydrolysis and collecting the hydrogen and oxygen off the anode and cathode?
I don't think you can make current energy plants 100% efficient, because that would violate some
or
of the
more efficient
physics. But you could make them more efficient.
Like clock around 24 hours a day.
Yeah. The problem is, as you probably know, is that what's happening with all of these electricity deregulation plans that have happened is it's creating a huge incentive for some of the cheaper, dirtier coal plants that hadn't been running around the clock to get fired up so they can sell electricity into the deregulated states. So we're seeing an increase in air pollution from these coal-fired power plants, and we certainly wouldn't want to take a step backwards by running these dirty power plants longer in order to get a cleaner fuel cell. So I think the real answer has to be developing the fuel cell technology to the point where fuel cells become cheaper and more compact, and two is figuring out new ways to generate hydrogen or old ways to generate hydrogen from energy sources that have been underutilized and are cleaner.
Thank you for that. I hope we move to hydrogen soon.
I hope so, too.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to somebody else here. This is a caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I agree with the previous caller about the hydrogen. I think that's a great idea. I wanted to ask about why we aren't hearing more about using ethanol in a mixture with gasoline.
Ethanol is one of those areas where it could be beneficial. It can also have some drawbacks. And so our position on ethanol is that if you're going to be, and I know this will make me unpopular with some listeners, but if you're going to be deriving ethanol from crops that have very high inputs of energy to grow them, then it's probably not worth it from an energy point of view to develop ethanol that you're going to burn in cars or for other sources of energy, because you've already put in so much energy to grow it. You know, things like growing corn, which requires some fairly high inputs of chemicals and fertilizers.
And are you also talking about the machinery that they have to use?
Yeah, the machinery too, but also just the chemicals and those kinds of inputs. If you're going to generate ethanol, if you're going to derive ethanol from things that would otherwise go to waste, so you know, agricultural waste, those kinds of things, that actually might be a fairly beneficial idea from an energy point of view, because then that's stuff you were already going to waste, and so you're just extracting the energy from it. So it's a little bit tricky from our point of view, and we would definitely encourage, you know, more research and more work being done on getting ethanol out of some things that right now are just being discarded.
What kind of things are waste?
Agricultural waste, mostly. So crop residues.
Plant material or animal waste or what?
Plant material. I haven't looked so much into ethanol from animal waste. I think that would be tough, but there's some plant material, and there's good work being done on that where I think it makes a lot of sense.
What kind of plant material?
Different kinds of crop residues. I mean, I've seen some studies on rice straw and other kinds of crops. I imagine even crop residues from growing corn you could put into ethanol as well.
The corn stalks?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see more research on that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
All right. And back to another Urbana person. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, I generally agree with your guest's take on the whole topic and the thrust of what you're trying to do, of course. But I just thought I'd throw something out there for you, see if you could deal with this. And I hope you don't treat it too flippantly, but... I heard someone, I think in the last week, try to argue in favor of Bush's approach, which of course is very self-serving to him and his industry, and not very wise or doesn't look out for the greater good at all. But at any rate, this one guy tried to defend it is. He basically said that our economy, as many people would agree, is focused on adolescence and midlife crises, and that the reason conservation would not succeed here is because people are drawn to America for full-tilt, carefree consumerism, not a careful, moderated life. The more I think about it, the more I think he may be right. I was just wondering if there is any part of your strategy which tries to approach that particular problem. Now, what I see as a problem, and what this fellow did as well. I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay.
That's a really intriguing question. And part of what the Bush administration also tried to do, in part because people were so angry after they, you know, were so focused on dirty energy supplies and not enough on conservation. So part of what the Bush administration's been trying to do, and some others in some of the bigger extractive industries, is they're trying to say, well, you know, conservation means sacrifice, and, you know, these people, they want you to just shiver in the dark. And we are a very consumptive society. The U.S. has about 4% of the world's population, and we use 25% of the energy resources. So we use a lot. The good news is that while President Bush wants people to sacrifice their health because, for example, he is looking at increasing pollution from power plants and refineries as part of his energy plan and increasing radioactive waste produced from nuclear power plants, that's the kind of sacrifice that would be involved in the Bush plan. Plus, there's nothing to protect consumers from high prices being charged by power generators or by oil companies. So we'd be sacrificing with our pocketbooks. The good news is that we can actually be smarter with how we live our lives and use technology to make us more efficient, use brains. Things like cars that go further on a gallon of gas are a good example. Things like air conditioners. I mean, the problem is President Bush already rolled back an air conditioning standard that would have decreed that air conditioners be 30% more efficient. Now, at least one manufacturer has said it could meet that standard. This means, this is very important, during the hottest time of the summer is when electricity demand is at the highest. This is when people are cranking out their air conditioners. It's when when there's going to be the biggest crunch, for example, in California. And so making air conditioners that use less electricity to accomplish the same goal, to cool people's lives, is a very good thing, and yet President Bush rolled back that standard. That's very short-sighted. We say we can do better and do smarter and have people maintain the same quality of life. And it doesn't mean wasting energy. It means having cars, appliances, buildings that are smarter, that accomplish the same goals by using less energy. And this has actually already happened. Compared to the 1970s, the U.S. uses 40% less energy than it otherwise would have if it weren't for all of the energy efficiency standards that we've already passed. So the existing miles per gallon standards, the existing appliance standards, all of those things already have resulted in reducing our energy consumption in a way that still allows us to enjoy a very high standard of living. And what PERG is saying and other groups are saying is we need to maximize our use of these technologies so that we aren't, you know, polluting ourselves and polluting the planet so much, and that we are being as smart as we can about energy use.
Well, that's the kind of thing, really, that your friend, the legendary Mr. Lovins, has been saying for a couple of decades now.
Exactly.
Although he seems also to be one of those voices crying in the wilderness that probably doesn't get the attention that he should. And I guess I find myself going back to when we were talking with the caller from Chicago and thinking that because we are not only going to have to change people's mindsets, but we are going to have to fundamentally change the economy if we're going to move away from this great reliance we have on fossil fuels. I'm not sure that that can happen without a kind of leadership from the Congress and from the president. Someone, I don't think it's going to be this president, but some president is going to have to say, look, we're going to have to change things, and we know that we can't do it overnight, but we're going to have to, as a matter of policy, say we're going to start, and we're going to start today. Is it going to happen? Isn't that what's going to have to happen for the change to happen? And until the president does that, stands up in front of the reporters and the TV cameras and says that, things really aren't going to change very much. They may change incrementally, but not dramatically.
Well, David, I think that's the wonderful thing about our country, is that it's not just the president who makes decisions. It's not just the Congress who makes decisions. There are many different levels at which these kinds of decisions can be made. I don't think that any decision that is based on a political process is going to be sweeping and radical anyway. I think that these current energy problems are giving us an opportunity to have a debate about issues that most people haven't thought about for decades. And President Bush, unfortunately, I think has been listening too much to some of his big campaign contributors who have a very specific interest in mind, their profits, and their profits are going up. The Congress, on the other hand, is beholden to the people who elected them. So they've got a whole different interest in mind. Sure, they take campaign contributions as well, and so there's going to be some competing voices there. But I do think that folks have an opportunity right now to make their voices heard and to say, we want a smarter, cleaner energy future. We need to start to move towards that. That doesn't mean shutting down all coal, nuclear, oil wells, et cetera, tomorrow. What that means is using the technologies that we have right now to be smarter and cleaner, figuring out how do we actually move forward into the future. For example, one of the benefits of increasing production from renewable energy sources is that you can actually help farmers. Wind energy is a huge untapped potential in this country. Farmers in Iowa who have wind turbines on their farm can still plant 95% of the acreage or graze it as well, and they make $2,000 per turbine per year in electricity revenues. So that's the kind of thing that we ought to be thinking about. We're definitely working with other constituencies, with farm groups, reaching out to labor, all those kind of groups. The religious community has gotten very much involved because they're very concerned about the future of the entire planet and, you know, humanity's stewardship or lack thereof of the planet. So there's a number of voices that are starting to get involved in this debate, and folks need to make their voices heard. We don't need to go back to the past. We don't need more pollution. We don't need relaxed air pollution laws to deal with this energy crisis. We have the technology to do things better, and it's a huge opportunity for us to start.
We're almost out of time, and suddenly the phone lines have lit up. We'll probably only be able to take one of these folks. We'll take the first person in line. That's Champaign County, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I can't hang on, so just react to this, which is the renewal of the Price-Anderson Act. This is about nuclear power operators and limits their liability. The people are saying that there's a new generation of atomic plants coming on, but the Bush plan actually calls for the nearly doubling of the lifetime of current plants, which leaves us susceptible to the embrittlement that's due to the neutron flux. These things should have been, some of them should have been put away a while back, and they're talking about licensing them further. So the Price-Anderson Act is, I think, coming up, and if you just have a few words about that, because I think it's an extremely important issue here in Illinois where we get, I think, approaching a third of our energy, and we are indeed downwinders here in Champaign-Urbana. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Nuclear power is unsafe, unaffordable, and generates dangerous radioactive waste. That hasn't changed. These new nuclear power plants that have been proposed, I've taken a look at some of the proposals. They will still generate radioactive waste. There's no solution for that. Nuclear power in this country would not be alive today if it weren't for enormous federal subsidies and programs to prop it up. The caller's right. There's something called the Price-Anderson Act that is a limit and liability for nuclear power plant operators. It's actually a complete exemption from public liability for those who design and build the plants. That means if there is an accident at the plant and people are injured or hurt or develop illness as a result, you as a member of the public cannot sue the person who designed the plant. These new nuclear designers, these companies, one in particular, Exelon, is arguing that its new design is very safe. It is inherently safe and very cheap. They are arguing that it's very cheap at the same time that they are cutting costs by not building or not proposing to build a conventional containment around the reactor. We feel that's very dangerous, and we also feel that this company is being very hypocritical because at the same time that it's talking about how cheap and how safe this new plant would be, it is lobbying to have this Price-Anderson Act, this limit on liability, apply to its new plant. And we have issued a challenge to them, and we issue a challenge to any nuclear power plant operator to say, look, if your plants are in reality so safe to operate, then why do you need to limit your liability in case of an accident? Either they're safe, or they're not. And if they're not safe, they should be shut down.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we're at the end of the time, but real quick, I'll mention that on Thursday of this week at 10 o'clock, we'll be talking some more about nuclear energy. David Lochbaum will be the guest on that day. He's a nuclear safety engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists, so maybe we can get back to some of this, some of these points. But for now, we'll have to say to you, Ms. Aurelio, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest, Anna Aurelio, Legislative Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.